Coming to you live from a stately pleasure dome, I'm Tom Rich, and with me as always is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, and this is the Mildly Alarming Podcast. Episode 3D8 plus 1, Deeply Confusing Callbacks.
Welcome back to the Mildly Alarming Podcast. I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And I'm Gross Nipply Tentacle Boobs.
Oh man, you beat me to the punch on that.
I do try. You're going to have to bleep most of that, aren't you?
No.
Boobs isn't a swear?
I think you can say all of those words on television, and so that's pretty much what I'm going with these days on the censorship.
Fair enough.
That's why I leave ass in, and jackass is fine, but I take out...
Weird.
And since it's censored, no one will know what that word is.
I think they can make an educated guess.
Especially since I make a vague effort to match the farm animal noises in some way, so that they either sound like the word anyway, or are... You know, in this case, made by the animal.
Clever.
Now you know.
For those who are deeply confused, Gross Nipply Tentacle Boobs is a reference to the art style of the aliens in the TV show Rick and Morty, which is very funny and you should watch.
It's so great.
Also, on the note of
gross... Unless you are watching TV with your parents or are perhaps one of our parents.
And this is a good time to mention that... I don't know if I mentioned this to you, that our friend, let's call him Paul, said he might tune into the podcast. So hello, Paul. I hope you enjoyed that intro.
Paul, who will have no idea who we're talking about.
Oh, I think he can make an educated guess. Welcome back to the show, though. We're glad to have you with us on the show, listening in with your ear parts or your nose parts, whatever. You do you. He's Johannes. I'm Tom. We're talking about board games, and we're glad you're here. So what's on the agenda for tonight, Johannes?
I got distracted. I'm actually wondering if you know.
Well, I feel like that's okay since you are podcasting with damaged fingers this week.
That's actually what I was thinking about that made me totally zone out when you asked me a question. I was thinking about, so I count us in before we record. I give a three, a two, and then I don't say the one. Like we're professionals, but we're not.
We're the opposite of that.
Yeah. But I also count down on my fingers, except I broke my pinky last week, and so it is taped to my ring finger on the hand that I would normally count down with. But I can't remember that, so I keep trying to hold up three fingers, and the pinky just goes up with the ring finger every time. And then I'm like, I guess that's four, but I can't count down from four because two are going to go down at the same time. And then we laugh and laugh.
What you just got to do is go... 4, 3, 2, 1.
Or just 4, 2, 1 and see if it throws you.
Well, then you would be skipping 3.
Right.
It's not how numbers work.
So it would throw
Johannes.
You. Which sounds like a win in my book.
Fair enough.
But I guess we're talking about winning or winners.
No, it says WinRARs.
Well, WinRARs.
So we're talking about zip files today.
Well, actually, RAR files in that case. Like WinRAR can open zip files.
Isn't a RAR file just a zip file with a different extension?
No, a RAR file and a zip file are both archive files of a type with just different types.
I'm sorry, I was literally asleep because that was so incredibly uninteresting.
Yeah. Zip file is a so RAR and tar gzip.
I kept breathing in on the snoring I was doing there, and then
you
I couldn't.
How to breathe
I,
out.
I didn't breathe back out, and it was just all in my body.
It's too bad you can't die of too much air.
You can. Oxygen toxicity is a thing.
I didn't say too much oxygen. I said too much air.
Oxygen.
That is what I said.
I'll bet you could die from too much air. Like if you just kept pumping it in without letting it back out, eventually you're gonna pop.
Well, right, but now we're talking about too much air being pumped into you, not just too much air.
Yeah, but you could breathe. You could just keep breathing in. That's what I'm saying.
Oh yeah, no, I don't think that is what would kill you. It wouldn't be too much air. If you were just breathing in, constantly inhaling, at some point you hit the capacity of your lungs.
No, but you have to have the muscles to keep the breathing going in.
Right. That's not possible. No, that's what I said to begin with.
No, you can do it. You'd have to
explode your own ribs.
You'd
train your intercostal muscles and to the point where you could actually rip your own rib cage open.
Is that what those
are called? The muscles between your individual ribs are
intercostals. Yeah, right under your pec. Yeah, your pec. Okay, so check this. I'm in a meeting with my boss and like two of the three team leads the other day, and then it's me, and I'm like, please don't fire me, because I'm terrible at my job. And
a dumb jerk.
I know, right?
Boot.
Just a total... And my boss, who is a lady, we're talking after the meeting is done, and she kind of rubs her underneath one of her arms and goes, this muscle kind of hurts right here. What is that muscle called? And I wanted to say intercostal as my boss is rubbing her underboob at me. But I'm like, I can't remember if that's the intercostal or if the intercostal is something gross, like reproductive system related. So I'm just not going to say anything.
I don't know of anything reproductive system related. Call it an intercostal. But if memory serves, intercostal, I don't remember what costal is, mm-hmm. but it sounds to me like one of those words that really you could have intercostal muscles in other places. It probably just means between
costals,
like something skeletal or something. So there could be ones in gross reproductive places also, mm-hmm. but I don't know. Like frenulum is a gross word, but it also just means like the flap of skin that any flap of tissue that attaches mm-hmm. like between loose tissue or muscle and an anchor point. So like the thing that holds your tongue to the bottom of your mouth is a frenulum.
Really?
And like the thing on your upper lip at the top there is a frenulum. There are also ones in gross ball related places.
Sure, sure. Huh, I didn't know that about frenulums.
Now you do.
And knowing is half the battle?
I guess. There's a condition called frenulum breve, where the frenulum on your tongue is like unusually short.
Mm-hmm.
So those people who have that sometimes have trouble speaking and like they can't stick their tongue out because it doesn't go out their
mouth. Can you treat that at all? Can you like go in and snip the frenulum?
I don't think you do. I think you just, you're like, well, I guess don't stick your tongue out because you can't.
Seems unfortunate for them.
So this has been our podcast about tongues.
Amazing podcast. I really hope Paul did decide to turn in and that this is the episode he chose to start on.
If he decided to turn in instead of tune in, which is what you just said, when he was finished, would he have turned in?
He might have.
Wow.
Well, it's always nice to have new readers.
I hate you so much.
Ah.
Well, I believe the mechanic, well, not a mechanic, the aspect on some level of gaming that we're talking about for this segment is winning or victory or whatever you want to call it.
And the fact that our segment is on winning tonight is in no way related to Charlie Sheen's recent announcement.
At least I found out about it later. Tom may have known and may be lying to you.
I would never lie.
Yeah, that in and itself is... Did I say in and itself?
I don't know.
In and of itself?
But no, it's 100% true.
Words are hard, you guys.
Words!
Yeah. So you made up this topic. What are we talking about?
Chicken dinners, it looks like. No, topic's called Winrars, Chicken Dinrars, but we're talking about winning. We're wondering about, you know, all games end eventually, even if it's just because, you know, grandpa throws you out of his house because Monopoly's gone on too long.
That sounds like a win for everyone.
Yeah, so the question is there some universal or are there general characteristics to winning in a tabletop game, or is it truly just... you know, whatever this particular game defines it as. Could you define anything as winning, including losing, and thus create a paradoxical loop that ends the universe? Yeah, that's where we're starting. So we're kind of wondering about that.
Haven't we played a game, or at least discussed a game, wherein... I guess it's not known for... Well, it could be known from the beginning and still be interesting, but I don't know if it was in the game we played where mm-hmm. losing is the win condition, but it's one of those, like, we revealed it at the end at the last second.
It might have been, I don't remember.
Okay.
We talked about a mechanic that I'd seen in a video game somewhere recently where you, as part of the game, you pledge support to other players.
Mm-hmm.
And at the end of the game, one player wins, but it's possible to have a certain trait or whatever where you're the power behind the throne.
Mm-hmm.
And if a player wins and you were supporting that player, you win instead.
Oh, yeah.
That might be what
No, that's not what I'm thinking of, but that was good too.
Yeah, so that would be kind of cool. But then that's still a win condition. You know,
right.
Pretty standard, you win, you don't win. So I'm just kind of wondering, is there something in general, are there certain characteristics that winning needs in order to be satisfying, or can you just define whatever win you've got, condition you want, and that's the win condition?
I'm pretty sure it's whatever's defined as the win condition.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like it's too... So if we were go to back to what we were just talking about, where the loser is the winner,
mm-hmm.
You have to have a way to have defined the loser and the winner for that game already.
Sure.
And if you say it flips at the end, we'll make it easy. In a normal game of this, most points at the end wins, mm-hmm. fewest points loses.
Sure.
Pretty easy. A lot of games use that mechanic. Except there's a card or something someone can draw, or something that's revealed on a timer or whatever,
mm-hmm.
that might change something about the game, perhaps the win condition. In this case, it says loser's the winner after it's too late for anything to happen. First of all, I think most people who play board games would hate that.
They'd make me mad.
It's like the leader shell times a million. It's it's not even leveling at this point anymore. It's just like, screw everyone who played this game except mm-hmm. the guy who was worst at it. If you were to say from the beginning, loser is the winner, now the game is just don't get a lot of points.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've already changed the win condition and you've changed the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not necessarily wrong or uninteresting, but it's no longer like to win is to lose. It's just, no, the winning is a different thing now.
Yeah. I guess let's flip the question around then and come at it the other way. Have we played any games where we felt like the win conditions were unsatisfying and didn't, where we felt like, yeah, I won and I don't feel like that was...
I feel like a lot of Last Man Standing games are like that for me,
mm-hmm.
If that's the only win condition. I think Last Man Standing in a game with other victory conditions, depending on the game, can either be incredibly gratifying or kind of disappointing. Like, well, that seems like a cop-out.
Mm-hmm.
Like a Last Man Standing win on... I was going to say a Last Man Standing win in Big Man would be disappointing, but I think that would actually be kind of sweet.
If you ever...
If you managed to...
It'd be hard to pull off, yeah.
If you managed to kill all three other players, like, mm-hmm. good on you. I was going to say also that a Last Man Standing win on King of Tokyo would be good. I'm just going to flip what I was going to say. Last Man Standing win on Tokyo could be good if you're the monster. King of Tokyo or King of New York could be good if you're the monster in the city and you actually dealt the damage.
Mm-hmm.
But if you just kind of hung out unnoticed and managed to be Last Man Standing, unless that was your clever strategy and you somehow managed uh-huh. to pull it off without someone in like the third act being like, wait a minute, he hasn't done anything. How many health points do you have?
Mm-hmm.
And like, if you managed to make it that long, you probably did something right. So that's kind of interesting, but it could be really disappointing. Just mm-hmm. like, I just sat here and no one noticed and then they all mm-hmm. died and then I won.
Yeah, so it's kind of got to be tied into your actions and choices fairly directly.
Yeah, I think so.
Like you have to have had some input on
yeah.
the matter.
Well, like if you go back to what I was saying before, a game... where the win condition, if the win condition were to change like on the last turn, so no one can do anything about it,
mm-hmm.
it's not really a satisfying win anymore.
But if it changes, say, four turns from the end, where there's still some time
a mad
to adapt,
scramble,
yeah.
So we talked about a game idea. I don't think we ever mentioned on the air, and one of us pitched it to the other as sort of a doomsday preppers kind of game.
Oh yeah.
And we talked about it a fair amount. I still think we could maybe do something with it. Where you're prepping for doomsday. You're mm-hmm. you're trying to build up a cache of whatever you think you need to survive the coming apocalypse. But in what we discussed, and we never got very far with this, but in what we discussed, the idea was that basically a win condition, whatever the apocalypse is going to be, isn't revealed until maybe halfway through mm-hmm. the game or later. And so you have to make a guess at what you think it's going to be. Is it going to be a zombie apocalypse? Is it going to be a super virus? Is it going to be an asteroid? And figure out what you actually need to stockpile and build in order to prep for the coming mm-hmm. apocalypse. And you don't know until later in the game. That could create either just a disappointing, it flipped at the last minute and eventually everyone has to just come up with the most homogenized, boring, average out everything strategy until the flip, you mm-hmm. know, the twist, or it could be really interesting. There could be strategy to it. We'd have to probably add some mechanics to it.
You would need, you'd almost want there like a series, some way to do a series of clues as to what's about to happen.
Yeah.
Too, so you can start to pick up and hedge your bets a little bit. Yeah, but yeah.
You would need to be able to, yeah, to strategize some.
I wonder if that idea that the win shouldn't be like a weird surprisey thing. You should be able to kind of see it coming almost. Uh-huh. Not you know, hours or many, many turns in advance, but relatively in advance. It shouldn't come out of the blue.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's sort of the source of frustration a lot of people have with like Euro-y style games where there's a lot of victory point scoring at the end, uh-huh. where it feels like, well, we just played this game and I thought I was doing well, but it turned out, you know, there was some surprise thing I didn't know about that was scoring him a bunch of points, or the right. math didn't work out like I thought it was in my head.
Yeah.
And that scoring process kind of sucks a little bit of the life out of determining the win.
Well, I think, I don't know, I think you're kind of hitting on opposite ends of the spectrum almost there. Because mm-hmm. I think the problem with for a person who doesn't like Euros in that situation isn't so much, and that's Euros, the game's not Euros, the sandwich. the problem with that is, on the Euro side of things, now I have to do a math problem. Maybe mm-hmm. I didn't mm-hmm. know a thing that like we just played Alchemists. It was the first time for me. I didn't know that favor cards that you held in your hand at the end were worth victory points. Mm-hmm. And I would have trounced all of you.
Right, right.
If I had known that, because I had tons of them that I was just burning because I didn't think I needed them and mm-hmm. they didn't help me. Sure. If I had hung on to them, I would have beat everyone. So the problem then is that it's that there's a lot of crap to keep in your head. That's the Euro problem. There's a lot of stuff to remember, a lot of calculations to do, and the end isn't like obvious winner. It's like 10 minutes of math mm-hmm. and then a winner. Where on the flip side, if there is a surprise twist at the end, even in the scoring phase, that is a very non-Euro randomizing element be a Euro game.
Sure.
So I think that's sort of opposite ends of the spectrum. I think you're right on both counts as far as the winning mechanic mm-hmm. and how you would feel about it, but I think they're different things.
Okay.
But I was listening to the Designing Cardboard podcast, mm-hmm. which, if you like the board game talk parts of our podcast and don't think we're funny or think humor has no part in board games, you'll enjoy their podcast because they do a very good job talking about raw mechanics, and they have some cool stuff that I've been tempted to steal, but I'm trying to be good. They do this Games from a Hat segment mm-hmm. where they pick a mechanic, a restraint, and a theme. Constraint. And a theme, and they each get 60 seconds to pitch a game using that. So anyway, pretty good. Check it out. Mm-hmm. They were talking about hidden information, and a game came up that in the very little they talked about it, and I forget entirely what it was called. It seems like it does basically what our Doomsday Preppers idea does, where the victory condition can change at the last minute mm-hmm. and sort of throw everyone's plan off. And I feel like there wasn't a really positive response to that, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So like you were saying, we would have to have hints leading up to it. I forget why I got back on this topic. Completely forgotten.
I got nothing.
You weren't paying attention to what I was saying.
No. Nope.
And I wasn't paying attention to what I was saying.
You mentioned sandwiches earlier, and I was thinking about sandwiches. I like sandwiches too. What if we made a game about sandwiches?
Hasn't that been done?
I don't know. Like anthropomorphic sandwiches that go on adventures.
Oh, I would. Let's make it.
Like, you could be a sandwich wizard, and like you're so you guys are from the sandwich kingdoms, and as you travel, you have to fight like other lunch foods. Like you might have to fight a bag of chips or a soda.
Uh-huh.
And like you could get like tinfoil as an armor, and like you've got one of those swordy toothpicks that you can fight with.
So that could be okay. I'm going to just run with your happy tangent. I played a game that I got from my brother's girlfriend at the time when he was in high school. So when I was quite a bit younger, called Brave Fencer Musashi
mm-hmm.
For the original PlayStation. And Musashi is a historical figure, I think, mm-hmm. in Japanese culture, a samurai or something of the sort.
Very famous swordsman.
In this game, you're some like terrible... You're a horrible child hero. Mm. And it's a very Zelda-style game in its gameplay. And this could just be how they translated it to English. It could be that this is not... In fact, thinking about it that way is super funny. They're like, we're going to do this for the Americans, but that's not how it actually was in the original. Because despite there being no, like, graphical references to food, like, mm-hmm. nothing looks like food. Everything just looks like a Japanese village and you're mm-hmm. fighting monsters. First of all, the voice acting is terrible in the English version, mm-hmm. but also all of the names are like the kingdom you're defending is all you can eat, all one word, A-L-L-U-C-A-N-E-A-T, and everything is named after food.
That's
like,
amazing.
I think the princess is just straight up Princess Hamburger. Everything is food related.
That, you're right. It's way better if some Japanese guy was just like, no. The Americans will love this. Or... let's troll the hell out of the Americans.
That never occurred to me until right now. Like, previously, I always thought, why is this the way that it is? This is so stupid. And just right now, explaining it, a switch flipped, and I was like, oh my god, they did this on purpose.
Either way is incredible.
But the game was actually pretty good. Mm-hmm. But that's cool. Yeah, food, anyway. The kingdom of all you can eat.
Right, so I'm thinking it's gonna have to be, you know, both class and race-based, like... You know, you got to have your fighter sandwiches, your wizard sandwiches, and so on.
Right,
but then you also need to have, like I feel like a burger is different, as different from a Reuben as an elf is from a dwarf. You follow me?
At least.
Yeah. So that's like your, like the type of sandwich is like the different races, and like a hoagie would be similar to like a giant, because it's longer than others. Yeah, it's a bigger sandwich.
A grinder.
Yeah. And like, but
navy
like.
Navy beans.
Sure. I don't know what you're doing.
It's the Lunch Lady song. Oh, Lunch Lady Land. In fact, we could call this game Lunch Lady Land.
Legit. And like, but you know when, you know the Neverending Story, that big dragon thing?
Looks more like a golden retriever than
a
dragon.
Yeah, that thing. Yeah. Whatever it's called. We have something
Falcor.
Like that. Sure. We have something like that. I've never seen it. Only cooler.
You've never seen it?
No, I haven't.
Jack Black is in it.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, he's like the bully at the beginning.
What?
Yeah.
My life just got a little bit more ridiculous.
Yeah, it's absurd. Everything about it is absurd.
But
you know that terrible band, Atreyu?
Yeah.
That's named after the main character from the Neverending Story.
I thought the main character was like a kid from like our world.
It's two main characters. But like he's reading the book, and he's the dumb kid getting bullied, but then the main character in the story who has a lot of parallels to the dumb kid is Atreyu, and he's like
this
a different also kid.
Oh, okay.
So anyway, something about the dog dragon.
We've got something like that helps out the players from time to time, or is like a force they can call upon. It's a party sub.
Nice. Like, so more like Kapora Gabe. No, but he's got to help.
Yeah. You know,
the owl from Zelda that just shows up and he's like, hey, read 14 pages of text. Accidentally hit A at the end and have to read it all again.
Yeah, exactly. Only, yeah, except useful.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Neat. Well, I guess look for Lunch Lady Land, the fully licensed Saturday Night Live board game coming probably never.
It's probably not going to happen. Winning.
The winningest. So I hate winning. That word. The word winningest.
Is that?
It's
right.
It's
they
only,
use it, they
it's
use
only
it
used
in sports.
In sports
ball.
Just
yeah.
sports.
Yeah.
Only sports.
They're the winningest team.
Sports! Yeah, anyway. It's a stupid word.
So the other question I had about victory was whether or not in any way that different degrees of winning are at all meaningful. So for example, if we're if we've got a space sim or whatever, and I say if you score, you know, if you defeat your opponents by a total of 10 points of biomass at the end that you've collected, you win a major victory. But if you only win by like 2 biomass, you win a minor victory or something like that.
Uh-huh.
Is differentiating like that at all meaningful, or is that just like okay?
My gut reaction is that in a competitive game, that's just obnoxious and pointless.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause either if it only applies to the victor. Say it's a 4-player game. If it's only levels of victory for the one guy, all it does is have the losers be like, haha, you only sort of won instead of totally won, which is pointless.
And spawns the argument of the victor coming back and say, yeah, but I still won.
Right. Conversely, the same situation, 4-player competitive, saying first player won, second player, if they had over 30 points or whatever, also sort of won.
Mm-hmm.
Like, unless you've come up with a really good mechanic that would probably have to include some somewhat complex calculation to really figure out, which sucks in and of itself, you're just kind of being like, yeah, you also kind of won. Good job, buddy. which just feels kind of like patronizing, you know, mm-hmm. just like, yeah, well, you sort of kind of won second place. Way to go. Here's mm-hmm. a silver medal. And then, but now if you take it over to a co-op game or a single player game, now levels of victory make sense, because it gives you a reason to keep coming back. And so for me, this stands out because this is the way I play a lot of video games, where mm-hmm. there's like, you can beat all the levels. Actually, it sucks for me because I'm completionist and mm-hmm. kind of anal retentive about my video games, so I need to do everything.
Right.
And so there's victory, but then there's 100%, you know, got all the coins or cleared the level or whatever mm-hmm. on every single
stage.
Double super mega victory. I will try for that until I give up on the game and never see the end of it, because I can't even say I'm going to play it to the end for the most part and then I'll go back and mm-hmm. do completion. So the game has to be really engaging. Like, I played and beat New Super Mario Brothers on the DS with 100% completion, but it took me a long ass time. And it's ridiculous. But so, do you see what I'm saying, though?
Yeah.
If you're playing cooperatively, just being like, well, we beat that one, let's go on to the next one. And especially in a board game, there's not usually that many stages. Mm-hmm. So they either have to be really difficult, so you don't win all that often. And then it gets that kind of reputation like Arkham, where you never win, or Space Alert, where you pretty much never win. Or you can say you can win them all, but there's another way of playing them, so it's still interesting. So beating all the seven missions that we made mm-hmm. doesn't burn out all the replay value of the game.
Sure.
What do you think?
No, I don't think it's particularly meaningful. I don't.
Even in a multiplayer?
Even in a multiplayer, I feel like degrees of victory, yeah, I would care, but I don't know that it would be enough to draw me back in if I didn't get the highest on it. If the game itself, if it wouldn't have drawn me back with just one tier, I don't feel like multiple tiers would do anything for me to make me want to come back. What might is if you in a co-op, this wouldn't work. Well, it might work in a semi-co-op or a semi-competitive uh-huh. thing. What might work is like if individual players had individual win conditions, so that I won because I met my objectives. Gary didn't meet his, you met yours, so we two succeeded. There wasn't really one winner because we were more engaging with the system at, you know, perpendicular to each other.
Sure.
Instead, rather than, and sometimes our goals coincide and sometimes they didn't.
Yeah.
And so you're just really looking, did I succeed at my task? Cool.
I don't like those. I'm not saying they're inherently bad, but mm-hmm. I don't tend to enjoy them, where it's like, it's a co-op, except there's a winner at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, screw you, then it's not co-op. Don't paint it that way, dick.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it bothers me a lot. And like, there are times when I've seen it done okay, but really, and for the most part, I'm just like, don't call it a co-op and then say, except only one of you wins.
Because
now, not only, like, you can't play it co-op because you know there's a winner, mm-hmm. but you can't play it competitively because you designed the whole game as a co-op. Like, you just didn't know what you were doing with this game. Mm-hmm. Pick one mm-hmm. and make it good.
Well, there's a game called Archipelago that's like that.
Yeah.
It's semi-co-op, and you can attack each other and cause each other problems, but you can also just cooperate. Like, you can literally go either way, and there's a way to win as a group.
Right, but there's a way to win as a group. So there's a coalition victory, or there's an individual victory.
And
it's not like, work together, but still at the end, one of you mm-hmm. wins more than the others, or one of you wins and the other ones don't.
And so the victory kind of depends on what your group has agreed to do ahead of time, and also who's in your group. Like, did you bring Alphonse? Because he's betraying you.
Right.
It's what he's doing. He's in my home stabbing both of us right now.
Now, with a hidden traitor kind of thing, and not even necessarily a hidden traitor, because everyone's always suspect at mm-hmm. that point until you know who it is. But with I don't think I've seen anyone but Betrayal do this, but Betrayal at House on the Hill, you could all work together until the haunt starts.
And then
you're like, oh, I wish I hadn't helped that guy by giving him that statue that makes him move faster or whatever. But there was no way of knowing because he didn't even know.
Right.
That's a little better in my mind.
Sure. So do you, the last kind of thing I was thinking about with this is, could you have a success, a game that was fun and worth playing that had a defined ending? Like it ends. It doesn't just go until you stop.
Right.
But there's no winner, really? Like it doesn't separate the players out into successful and unsuccessful winners and losers? Do you think that's even possible? And what would that game's theme and like mechanics even look like?
I think it has to have a victory condition, but it doesn't necessarily have to be victory over other players.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things... So Arkham does this. Basically, what you've described is a typical co-op game.
Mm-hmm.
Your victory is over the game.
Sure.
Or whatever the game has set up as your goal. And Arkham, you know, it's pretty cut and dry to either you defeated the Ancient One or you got devoured.
Right.
Win-loss. You could have it be like, well, you got 60% to your goal of making $1 million or whatever the... So it's now it's basically a soft victory condition.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much a game in the board game world with no victory condition works, at least as a sit-down and play it once. Now, if you look at video games... there's a lot of open world stuff with no victory condition.
Mm-hmm.
Minecraft as a prime example. But mm-hmm. even Minecraft, where the focus of the game is really gaining, like acquiring materials and building stuff, they felt the need pretty early on to add a sort of win condition. The Ender Dragon was the boss of the game when the Ender Dragon came out, and they have since added other bosses. So now they're more like missions that you can decide to go take on.
Mm-hmm.
But they felt the need to add game elements. But the thing about Minecraft as compared to most board games is it's persistent.
Right.
So when you log off Minecraft for the day, all your structures are still there. All of your gold and stone and whatever that you've mined out of the ground is still there,
mm-hmm.
as long as you put it in something and didn't just leave it laying there. And so it's a lot easier, like, because Minecraft doesn't take up physical space.
Mm-hmm.
You can do that. A board game that's persistent, you'd have to leave set up on a table somewhere. So it could be done, but I think it would be really difficult.
Sure.
So as an inherent game, whatever a game is, mechanic, I think a victory condition isn't necessary.
Mm-hmm.
But for board games where the approach is generally play it a few times or once or maybe a few times if it's a particularly big game and you have a table to leave it set up on for three rounds or game days or whatever, mm-hmm. you pretty much need something to force an end.
Sure.
Because otherwise you just play it forever. The other thing is, maybe this is just me, and I know it's not just me, but maybe it's my personality type or my brain. I run out of patience for board games much more quickly than I do for video games.
Mm-hmm.
So take that as you will.
Yeah, I know that. I think about it every morning when I put in my glass eye. Ring the stolen joke bell.
Ding. Thanks, Penny Arcade, for most of our jokes. Pretty much.
We appreciate your we appreciate all of your hard work that we in no way compensate you for.
Yep.
Wait, no, I bought a t-shirt once.
Some of their books, too.
Yeah. I want one of those coffee mugs they used to do.
Do they not do those anymore?
Maybe they do. I haven't looked in years.
I backed their podcast on Kickstarter.
How'd that work out for you?
I got their podcast.
On like, Kickstarter?
They continued making it. Plus, I got access to it before everyone else, but I didn't really care about that part. Mm-hmm.
You just wanted them to keep making it.
Yeah. If I had free money floating around, I would do their Club PA or whatever it is mm-hmm. that gets you early access to stuff.
Club PA.
But I don't. I don't have money. I have no money. Pa. I think there's an A.
Pa.
Well, got anything else on winning?
No.
All right, then. We'll be back after this word from our sponsor. But if you want to tell us things about winning, hashtag winning, or just regular winning, you can hit us up on Twitter at @mildlyalarming.
You could send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
Or you could leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com.
Or you can put on your best suit and tuxedo, just one or the other.
Or both.
Order a dry martini.
Or a wet martini.
Wait at the fanciest casino you can find, and our agent will make contact with you. You'll know. And that is what they call foreshadowing. Foreplay?
Neither of those. We'll be right back.
Hey everybody, Paul Smenas here, founder and CEO of Paul Smenas Microerections. If you got a tiny thing made of wood that you need to raise up, just give Paul a little call and my staff will be hard at work in no time. Mini barns? We do those. Little gazebos? Absolutely. Tiny decks? You bet. Paul Smenas Microerections, your source for minuscule hardwood.
CastPod, welcome back. Tom!
There was missing so many words.
So many words.
And I'm Johannes Stauffer.
And we're glad to have you here back at the Mildly Alarming Podcast. How you doing?
Alarming.
Alarming.
Yeah, it's not very Minnesota nice.
Let me tell you about Minnesota nice. I got nothing to follow that up with.
I was so excited. No stories?
No, nothing.
Where does your wife's family live?
Minnesota.
That's what I thought.
They're just genuinely nice people.
That's disappointing.
Yeah, you were hoping they would secretly be like Satanists or something?
Or just, you know, passive aggressive.
Mm-hmm. No, just...
Just regular old nice?
Just nice.
That doesn't sound like Minnesota nice. That sounds like regular nice.
It's as far as I can tell, they're the same thing.
Now, is it the case that they're nice? Or is it the case that you're horrified your wife or one of them will listen to the podcast and hear the mean things you want to
say? No, I think it's the first one. It's not like Southern hospitality where it's clear that they hate you, but they're just doing their thing, you know? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Where they're like, oh, well, bless your heart. And you're like, you clearly want me to die. You clearly just are still bitter about the Civil War.
And you were somehow an integral part of.
Right, right. And you would like me to be run over by a car.
Are you sure you don't just think they hate you because you're black? Guys, Tom has been black this whole time.
That's the amazing revelation of the podcast. I'm just not even going to go anywhere on this, and there's no safe ground anywhere.
Nope.
Left for
me there.
I
shouldn't even have said that.
You shouldn't have. We should probably back up and undo this segment. Can we jump to a timeline where that didn't happen?
No.
Do we have the technology to switch timelines again?
No.
We did it once.
We did it more than once, but Gary broke it.
Damn it, Gary.
I know, right? He ruins everything.
He ruins everything.
And I can't go back because we'll run out of tape. Which we use.
To record the podcast.
Right, tape.
That we then put
on
the internet.
Tape.
Every time you cue it up to listen, one of the many copies of it on our giant deck of tape players spins up and starts going.
Yep.
So that's why only like 80 people can listen at one time, which we've only ever had zero. So...
But you get that sick tape delay that people like so
much.
Yeah,
and you get the little hisses and pops sometimes. That's why my voice sounds like that. It's because of the tape. It's not because I have a giant gap in my teeth that air flies through like a freaking wind tunnel.
Nice.
It's handy for spitting, though. I can get just a nice stringer going that
at least
gets a little bit of range.
Your tooth gap gives you an excuse for your occasionally lispy speech. Mm-hmm. I'm just lispy because maybe I'm secretly gay. I don't know.
Again, probably not okay. Honestly.
Do you ever listen to yourself, though, and be like, oh, man, that sounds like a stereotypical gay man?
Oh, stereotypical, sure. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. That's what I meant.
It's definitely the occasional Hans and Dieter moment. For those not in the know, Douglas Adams, the author of the excellent Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy series, wrote a book called Last Chance to See about the time he went around the world looking at endangered animals before they disappeared. Really weird, weird book, but very interesting. Like, I remember it, which is unusual.
Can't imagine Douglas Adams writing a weird book.
Yeah, I know, right? But there's a bit where I think there...
Or you remembering meaningless trivia
from a
book.
Yeah, I guess that wasn't
read.
Surprising at all.
None of that was surprising.
Fair enough. But, there's a bit where I don't remember where they were actually, I'm not going to call it, but they encounter two German people on their travels, named Hans and Dieter, I think it was, and they are completely stereotypically German, just, you know, like clockwork on time to everything and efficient and always talking about superior German engineering and just... Anything you imagine when you think the word stereotypical German, these guys were. And Douglas Adams was so disappointed to have encountered such a real stereotype that he decided they were Lithuanian instead. and was just like, no, these were the two Lithuanian guys I met, because they, I just can't handle it if they're German.
Which is funny, because he plays into British stereotypes so much himself.
Yeah, yeah. I adore Douglas
Adams. What's the bit about sandwiches? I can never get it right.
Yeah, you know, sandwiches at train stations are penance for whatever Britain's national sins are. Make them spongy, make them rubbery, wash the buggers once a week if you have to keep them fresh. There's more to it. It goes on and on for pages and pages, because why wouldn't it? Yeah, exactly. Oh, gosh, that's good stuff. He left us too soon.
I don't disagree, but that was just the most unbearably cheesy way you could possibly have put that.
I wanted to cause you uncomfort, discomfort.
I hate uncomfort so much.
Wait, uncomfort is a thing people say?
No.
Oh, good.
No. No one but you.
Oh, good, because I thought I was making a reference to a real thing. I was deliberately trying to say a word that was not real.
Uh-huh.
That was what I was going for. I was afraid I'd stumbled upon a thing people really say.
Yeah, I've done that.
Then I would have to no longer live among mortal humans.
Only immortal humans.
Yeah, I would just have to go hang out with only people who don't die.
In Atlantis or something?
I think you're thinking of Atlanta.
What if people in Atlanta just didn't die?
Have you ever been to that airport? It's clearly purgatory.
Yeah, that's a fair point.
Are we podcasting about board games?
Not yet.
Fair enough. Welcome to segment two of the podcast. We played a game called Redacted that we want to talk about. Johannes bought it and then forgot he'd bought it, and then it finally shipped. He's like, oh, now I have this toy that I bought.
And then it sat on my end table for a while.
And then we finally got a chance to play it. And so we thought it would be a good idea to talk about it on the show. Well,
more than forgetting that I bought it, I forgot why I bought it. Like, it showed up and I was like, this seemed really interesting to me at the time. And then I was like, I had had several beers and at least one gin and tonic. And
fair enough.
Yeah.
So Redacted, we'll put a link to the Board Game Geek page in the show notes so that you can go look at it if you want. Redacted is a game of Cold War spycraft, where teams of spies are at a reception at an ambassador's villa, which is represented by the board, and you have to move around the board attempting to complete your mission objectives, basically. Only the problem is you don't know anything about anybody else. You don't know who the other, say, Soviet spy is. You don't know where what you're looking for is, if you're looking for intelligence or whatever. And we only got to play a couple of the different missions in it, and only with four players. It goes up to six.
And also one of the missions we played was the setup, first time play mission.
Yeah, the intro mission. It includes also a mechanic whereby when you interrogate somebody to find out information about them, neither of you, the player you interrogated doesn't know what you found out about them. They shuffle three cards together, give them to you. You shuffle the cards again, look at them, shuffle them, give them back. So you have neither of you has any idea what happened.
One card is completely meaningless. One card gives a potential insight into their ability to do combat.
Mm-hmm.
And one card tells you outright what their loyalty
is. So they don't know what you found out about them.
Yeah.
So I feel like Redacted was damaged in our esteem a little bit by the fact that I rushed reading the rules a little bit, and so I didn't understand as well as I should have before a first play. And maybe I'm wrong here, the rule book wasn't in English on its first pass.
I get the feeling you're right.
And the translation didn't do it justice.
Yeah.
There were some areas where I felt like it wasn't translated as well as it could be. But let me tell you how Redacted played out in the game we played of the real mission, from my perspective.
Yeah.
I feel like that sells the spycraft storytelling of it the best.
Yeah.
So I was a Soviet spy. My goal was to find intel about the Americans at this reception, call a Soviet helicopter, and then fly away in it with the intel. I didn't know who there were three other players. Two of them were American. One other was going to be Soviet. I went into the basement of the villa, wandering around down there, and found our friend Devin was playing. I found Devin, who had just called a Soviet helicopter. And I said, huh. So I went down there. I ran across Johannes, who I proceeded to interrogate. I beat him up and interrogated him and found out that he was my Soviet counterpart. I'd found some piece of info that told me that. Realizing this, I then proceeded to follow after him to try to make contact and say, hey, I am also Soviet. You know, let's go. Let's do okay
here. I didn't realize that happened.
This is what I was trying to do.
Yeah.
So I tried to, so thinking I need to tell him that I'm the Soviet, I told him I'm going to play my friendly interaction cards that we don't have to fight. That's what I'm going to do.
Entirely.
And so I gave it to him and he passed up and he attacked me because I'd just beaten him up and interrogated him. And I don't think at that point, did you find out?
No, I didn't find out until Devin beat you up and took the intel.
Sure. Okay. So at this point, I have tried to make contact with my counterpart and failed. So I rushed down to the basement, and because now I knew the other two were on the opposing team. I found Devin. I beat him up, and I got a look. No, I'm sorry. I missed a step here. First, I got access to an X-ray scanner, scanned Devin, and discovered he was holding the American intel. So now I know the Americans have the intel, and I know who my counterpart is. But my counterpart clearly doesn't trust me at all because I fought him twice now. I go down and I find Devin and I fight him in a stairwell and I steal something from him. It turns out it's a packet of C4. So I realize he called the Soviet helicopter down because he was going to bomb it, so I couldn't escape with the intel even if I got it. There's two helicopters available. If they destroy both Soviet ones, we lose. So I'm like, crap, I have to hold on to this bomb, get the intel, which I now know he has, away from him, and somehow communicate to Johannes that we're on the same team. Devin and I fight again, and he gets the bomb back from me. He proceeds to rush up to the roof and blow up the Soviet helicopter. Which,
well, meanwhile, Tom goes, right after that combat, goes, just, I'm putting it out there. Devin is an American. He has a bomb and the intel. He is going to blow up the Soviet helicopter.
At which point he does, and Johannes is like, okay, yeah, that was true. And everybody, so now all the cards are on the table. So now at this point in the story, the spies have figured out what's going on, and they're all desperately scrambling to get what they need and find a helicopter and escape.
So meanwhile, I'm playing. Gary was also playing, mm-hmm. and he turned out to be clearly the other American spy. And I'd spent most of the time like basically dancing around him. He would just be in my way, not even intentionally. Just like whenever I tried to do a thing, there he was. Mm-hmm. Trying to do a different thing, but ending up where I needed to go or where I needed to pass through. Mm-hmm. So I was distracted from you giving me useful information by that, and also by the people that were in my house that were not playing board games with us, who were deeply, deeply distracted.
So from a spy story perspective, you were distracted by the other spy.
Sure.
The other American spy. He was in your way, interfering with you, and you were you were almost following up a false lead.
Yeah, and he wasn't doing it intentionally either, because he also hadn't figured out what was going
on.
But at that point, for all intents and purposes, we were all individual spies not knowing what was going on.
So there was some interesting cloak and daggery stuff going on in that way, as the spies maneuvered around each other, not sure, just... And then, once the reveal came and Devin blew up the helicopter, you know, there's a devastating explosion on the roof, all freaking hell breaks loose as... Johannes and I are trying to beat up Devin and take the intel from him, and then we have to beat him up, take the intel, call a new helicopter, and then get away.
Before someone else blows it up.
Right. So Gary's fighting us. There's this brawl on the roof. At one point, I ran downstairs and locked the roof so people couldn't get off of it.
Yeah.
So I hit the lock so people were trapped up there as they fight each other. There was some dodging around the stairwell and blocking it. Gary got stabbed and was crawling bloody through the security room.
And the whole time we had the intel they needed and they had the intel we needed. Yeah. We're trying to do enough combat to steal one from the other, but we weren't really sure. They didn't know I had it, mm-hmm. and we didn't know which of them had it. Well, no, we did.
We knew Devin had it.
We knew Devin had it, but I kept fighting him and couldn't get it from him.
Yeah, we weren't able to beat him in combat. That was part of the problem.
Because when you fight someone for, like, he was complaining earlier in the game about the amount of extra crap he had in his, because you have a hand limit of 3 as far as items are concerned. He kept complaining, but it turned out to his advantage, and it turned out to my advantage too, because he would beat me in a fight and take something from me and not get the intel I had, so they didn't know I had it.
Right.
But I would fight him and win and get something useless that I didn't need from him, or like get something he had taken from me in a previous fight back. And so just he kept hanging. You draw randomly, so like it wasn't, he didn't get to choose what to give you. So we kept trying to get it back, and it never happened.
Ultimately, we ended up calling the game because we had to go get dinner, I think it was.
Something like that.
It was
that.
About that.
It had gone on for a while, too.
But that I loved the way it more or less, a spy movie basically emerged organically from the mechanics. The players shuffling around each other kind of cautiously for a while. And then a couple of quick reveals, you know, through some violence, some misunderstandings, and, you know, allies working at odds, in Johannes, in my case, for a couple of turns there. followed by just a desperate scramble. To, you know, the moment where the helicopter explodes and everybody realizes, oh, now we know what's happening here.
Yeah.
Followed by this desperate brawl on the roof. Loved it. Deeply cinematic and fully emergent from the mechanics. There was nothing about the mechanics that forced that narrative.
Yeah, it just happened.
Yeah. So I would recommend it on that alone.
Like, I liked it.
That was really cool.
I had a few problems with it. First off, we had a hard time with the rules. I think you're right, partially about the translation, partially because we were frustrated already with the translation, and so we were not inclined to be forgiving.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of rules, a lot of caveats to the rules,
yes.
A lot of little, I'm blanking on the word, but this should be the rule, except in this case where it isn't.
Exceptions, yeah.
Exceptions,
yeah.
A lot of exceptions to the rules, which I don't mind, actually. Mm-hmm. I know it's technically, if you subscribe to most theories of game design, not great to have a lot of exceptions, but that it looked like a game, I made this mm-hmm. comment, it looked like a game we would design.
Yes.
We'd be like, all right, here's a good base mechanic, but what if you have night vision goggles?
Yes.
There was a lot of that, and I actually appreciated it once I got the hang of it, but it takes some getting the hang of.
Yes. It's definitely a game that you need your best rules lawyer to sit down with the manual.
And memorize it.
Well, read it carefully and then hit Board Game Geek, because I haven't looked at them directly, but there are a bunch of threads in there that are like, rules clarification, or here are all of the things we had to figure out so that you don't have to.
Yeah. Another problem I had, and this is probably worth looking into a little more on the podcast later, is it was my game that none of us had played, that I had purchased. It was at my house. I'm hosting the game night. And so the success of this game really kind of like was a meter of, you know, how well I'm doing as a game day host. Like, I spent money on this game. I invested in this game. I'm pitching it to you, having also never played it. This is my game day to make. If you guys hate it, I have failed in some way.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching it and watching people get really down on it at the beginning was pretty disheartening.
Yeah.
And
it
was really hard for me to come back up to the level of enthusiasm that you eventually, because you are one of the strongest detractors as the guy who, you didn't even play the first game with us. You just ran it as a game master.
It's interesting that you say that, because I felt almost the same way, because I was the guy who had read the rule book.
Right, right.
So I'm like, if this game crashes and burns, it's partially my fault for not understanding the rules well enough and not conveying them as well as I could.
Which brings up a really good point about making your rule books good.
Yes.
Like, your rule book needs to not only be functional, it needs to sell the game, basically, in the first playthrough. Because your game could be great, but if you don't make it clear why your game is great and how your game is great in the first playthrough, or if you have very generous players the first couple plays, they're going to give up on it before they ever get to appreciate what you think is
definitely.
Good about it. And I think that's something we need to figure out with Big Man. Both of these games have the problem of a pretty decent game. I would say a good game with a lot of, it's just that little mini argument we had on the air last week, convoluted rules.
Yes.
It may be that the game itself isn't convoluted, but it's the sort of mechanic that is simple in concept, but try to put it on paper and you find that it takes a page.
Two, you know, there's a layout question too here.
Yeah.
In that I made it through the entire rules of the game, which covered all of the exceptions, all of the night vision goggles, what every one of the three floors worth of rooms in the villa did.
Yeah.
And then I get to the, and I'm like, that's a lot, but I think I can do it. And I presented it, and we get to the intro mission, and half of that is cut out.
Yeah.
I feel like that intro mission needed to be up front and centered on its own card, maybe.
I think they focused more on making the intro mission short than they did on making the intro mission an example of how the gameplay goes.
And that's a little bit on me, too, because I needed to read more.
Oh, sure.
I should have read more carefully.
And you may have, but looking at that mission, you would have had, if you had played the game already, you would know to tell us this. But just figuring it out from the book, you would really not have a lot of way of knowing that, intro mission. It makes sense that you would cut a lot of the mechanics out to give an idea of how the first game works. But they've cut so much out. That, so first of all, you've spent, you're right, if they given the intermission with his own separate rules or something up front, so you know not to bother going over the rooms that don't function and the items that aren't in there for the first play. That's good. But also, the mission itself is not indicative of the gameplay. I think they focus too much on making it short from a time standpoint and not enough on making it simple but indicative of how the game goes. Because the biggest problem I think with the intro mission was not just that these rooms don't work, that room doesn't work, these items aren't in, blah blah blah, but also there was one victory condition, and so the entire hidden information aspect of the game was almost made moot because so we talked about this when we were playing. Hidden information is interesting when it's cooperative and you're trying to figure out who's a good guy. We're all on one team technically, but there are traitors, right? When you're trying to find traitors, it's one thing. When you're all against one another and you're trying to find an ally or figure out your enemies, it's confusing, especially with four players, and the starter mission only works with four players. As soon as one person knows something for sure about one other player, they know everything. And there's only one victory condition. So as soon as that person knows the one thing, they know everything there is to know about the mission. Right. When you get into the real missions, there's multiple victory conditions. So in the first mission we played that was a real mission, your victory conditions were either blow up both of the enemy's helicopters or get on your own helicopter with the intel and get out. Already that adds a hugely complex additional level of victory condition.
Let's look at the information we got from that. When, at the time that Devin went down to the radio room and called a Soviet helicopter to the embassy, I don't think I yet knew that you were the other Soviet agent.
Yeah. See, and at that point, I knew Devin was not because I had the Soviet intel.
And he wouldn't have called, if he was a Soviet, he wouldn't have called the helicopter without it.
No. I had the wrong intel.
Right.
So I guess I didn't know, but I had an inkling.
Well, you knew, you had the Soviet intel, which the Americans were looking for.
Right.
And so if Devin were a Soviet, he wouldn't have called a Soviet helicopter without the correct. No, you're right.
No. So I had an idea. I knew that neither you or Gary had the other intel because neither of you had even made an attempt to call a helicopter.
Right.
So, and I didn't even know that. So I had an inkling, but it wasn't until it really went down.
But at that point, from my perspective, where I didn't know what anybody was, I didn't know anything about any intel, I now have to wonder, did he call that helicopter because he is my fellow Soviet agent and he already has the intel and I just need to...
Right, and that's...
You know, I need to protect him?
Or is it because he's a bad guy and he's going to blow it up? And it's interesting because if you don't know who your allies are and you're not communicating, you don't know who's doing what. Like, it's possible for one Soviet to win for both Soviets without them ever knowing they were allies.
Or even with the other Soviet actively working against them.
Yeah.
Because they think they're the one of the Americans.
They mistakenly think that.
Exactly, yeah. So that was cool. That was part of what made it. It felt very Cloak and Dagger, very Cold War spy movie there.
Also very, like, bumbling bureaucratic government, not two like the CIA and the FBI or whatever, not communicating with one another. They both had an agent in this embassy on the same mission.
Or if bumbling throws off your enjoyment, it felt very so deep cover you don't even know who your allies
are. That's good too.
You know, depending on whatever your jam is, it worked.
And then we haven't gotten to this yet either, and I hope to. I don't have the game right now. I actually gave it to Devin. Devin makes these really great foam inserts. One of my biggest complaints with this game is that the box not only has lousy inserts, it has no inserts. So a board game box came with what came out to be how many decks of cards? Like six? We didn't even use them all. Like 6 or 7 decks of cards and 3 boards and game pieces with no dividers at all. Like, it didn't even have the typical garbage, like, bent cardboard thing to make a bunch of stuff fit in a slightly smaller portion of the box. It was just like, here's all the stuff piled together. And Devin makes these nice craft foam cut and glued board game dividers. So I said, I will pay you for whatever you want, basically, to make dividers for this. So he has it right now. But I also got the expansion for the game, which adds even more cloak and daggery stuff. It's called
Mercenaries, I think.
I want to say Mercenaries. I don't think that's the name, but it adds Mercenaries, basically. It might be Mercenaries. Where your the plot device is basically you've been doing the spy thing for so long, you're ready to retire, and you're just looking for the biggest chunk of change you can get. And is it Mercenaries?
There's one called Mercenaries and one called Garden Party.
Oh, I definitely don't have Garden Party.
I wonder what Garden Party is. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead.
It probably adds another board. But the idea is that you're looking for the biggest chunk of change, and so now you could be on teams together, or you could be separate, and people's objectives change throughout the game, so there's really no way of knowing who's on your team anymore. And given how, with four players anyway, we felt like this sort of cut and dried, once you know who's on your team, you know who's on your team thing didn't always work perfectly, the ability for stuff to continue changing throughout adds a more... We really like the bluffing mechanic a lot, just in general, as a mechanic, and we felt like it didn't work as well in a competitive game like, and just with the information that's already available to you, a bluffing mechanic only goes so far.
Let's throw a caveat in there too, in that when we play games like The Resistance or Coup or Game of Thrones, any game where you're rewarded for lying to and manipulating the other players, like verbally, just how good are you, the person, at outfoxing the person sitting across from you?
Yeah.
We're not good at bluffing and that kind of stuff in general.
Yeah.
So that part of the game we didn't fully explore just because it's not our jam, really.
Yeah.
But if that's the sort of thing you guys, your group does well and enjoys, this could definitely fit there better than it did for us.
Yeah, because this'll take bluffing beyond just, no, I'm not a traitor, you're a traitor. That sounds like something a traitor would say, to like trying to do table talk with the person you think is your ally, or even know is your ally, without giving things away to the other players.
Right.
There's no mechanic to be like, walk to another room and have your secret conference for a while. It's just like, hey, how do you feel about helicopters right now?
And a question that was actually asked
several times.
And not only is there might you be trying to table talk with somebody you know is your ally, they might not know you're their ally.
You know what would be really interesting?
Two-way stuff going on, yeah.
Maybe it wouldn't work, but it popped into my head. A character who is not a spy.
Oh, my God.
Who's just wandering around, and so you might be like, how do you feel about helicopters right now? And they're just like, I like helicopters. They're pretty cool, you know? Vertical takeoff and landing's pretty sweet.
I would want to play that character.
It would be really hard. Yeah, you would excel at this, I think. But being able,
because I can't keep a straight face anyway.
Trying to get into the suspension of disbelief, like trying to identify with your character in a board game enough to not give away that you're like, I don't care, whatever. Helicopters are sweet. What are you talking about, weirdo? Might be difficult.
Yeah, you're right. Garden Party does add another board that is the garden.
Called it. So, Redacted. I enjoyed it. I'm pretty excited to get another chance to play it. I'm really excited to see the expansion in play. Hopefully they did a pretty good job of it.
Yeah, I would unreservedly recommend it. Like, if it sounds good, I don't think you'll be disappointed.
Yeah.
Take some time with the rules, though, to make sure you understand really, what's going on.
And if your first play, especially if you're doing the intro mission to start, if your first play is disappointing, give it at least one more chance.
Yeah.
Because it makes a big difference.
Yeah, I want to play more Redacted.
Glad I made a good purchase.
You did make a good purchase.
Half drunkenly in your living room before recording. Actually, I think between recording two halves of a podcast.
Incidentally, Redacted wound up being the first of two spy-themed games that we played on that particular game day.
What was the other one? Codenames. Going long on time, but let's touch it real quick.
Codenames was another one we played. Codenames involves a spread of 25 cards with just random, with the code names of agents on them, and they're just English words.
The cards are set out similar to the game Memory.
Yeah, it's just
but
a spread,
they're face up.
Yeah, 25 or a 5x5 grid. The teams are split into two teams of however many you've got, evensies. One member of each team is the spy master. The other members are spies out there. The spy master says a word like booty, and then a number like four, and that the word booty is supposed to connect to four cards out on the table.
It should be a descriptor that reasonably works with four of the word cards
on
the table.
That's all the spy master can say. the spies on that player's team have to then guess which words they are one at a time and just touch them. And if they're right, the spymaster puts a card of his color over the word. If they're wrong, the turn ends and whatever should be there. If it's a neutral, it goes there. If it's the other team, it goes there.
Yeah.
And then it passes back and forth.
The spymasters have a card showing them how which in the 5x5 yes. layout are their cards, which are the enemy cards, which are the neutral cards. And there's one called the assassin. And if you pick the assassin card as a player, not a spymaster, if they say booty 4 and you're like, oh, booty, treasure, I'm going to pick the treasure card. And the spymaster had in their head, booty only means butt. Mm-hmm. And they had forgotten but that treasure also makes sense. And mm-hmm. treasure was the assassin card. So you pick treasure, black assassin card, your team instantly loses.
Yeah. So unreservedly fun.
Dead simple, but a lot of fun.
Great, fast, easy to understand. I don't think anybody had any trouble following the rules once they were explained.
We had the rules going over twice only because I kept having to leave the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just tons of fun. Great one. Also unreservedly recommended by the Mildly Alarming Podcast. It also has a great mechanic for analysis paralysis players. It includes a sand timer.
Oh, I love it.
But there's no mandatory time you use it. Instead, if at any point somebody is taking too long to do whatever they're supposed to be doing, any player can just reach out, flip it, and then they have until it runs out to just do the thing.
Pretty sure it's a 60-second sand timer.
Yeah, it's not too long. Great mechanic. Doesn't impose itself on the game, but is there if you need it.
I'm seriously tempted to buy a 60-second egg timer and add it to most games we play, especially mm-hmm. Dominion. Like, hey, if your turn's going long, I'm sick of waiting. Sand timer.
Yeah, that's a mechanic that... that's a mechanic that should be in a lot of games, like some way of speeding it up, but it's also one that grafts onto a game nicely. Like,
yeah,
you could just have the timer
easy to add.
And just do it.
It adds player interaction, too,
mm-hmm.
where it might not otherwise exist.
Yeah. The hardest part with code names is that the spymaster is supposed to keep a straight face and not say anything.
Well, that is tough.
Well, their spies are just not understanding the what they were trying to say at all.
And understanding that is tough, the game designer put in a suggestion that the non-spymaster players on that team don't look at the spymaster mm-hmm. for basically facial expression hints,
right.
You know, tells
yeah.
for whether or not they got something right.
Absolutely great game. We really liked that one a lot. A good one with Redacted to make a spy-themed night.
It's a good. It's kind of billed as a party game.
Mm-hmm.
It works as a party game. It's simple enough, but it doesn't feel... For those who are hardcore board gamers mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call yourselves, it doesn't feel like, we're going to play charades. It's not like a schlocky, too easy party game. It's still enjoyable for, mm-hmm. I think, pretty much everyone.
Yeah, there's fun. There's fun to be had there. Absolutely good stuff.
All right, we're going pretty long here, so anything else to add?
We talked about how we like Redacted, we talked about how we like Coda. This was a positive segment.
Yeah, if you want to check out either of those, we'll have them in the show notes, so you can take a look. And our friend Devin, who owns Codename, mentioned that it is very new, and if you really want it, you can pay, you know, $50 or $60 for it, but apparently the plan is for it to only cost $20 or $30, so don't get ripped off just because it's new, because we recommended it to you. Keep an eye out on it for $20 to $30.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we have to say. If you have a suggestion for mechanics or games that we should check out and talk about on the air, you should let us know on Twitter at Mildly Alarming.
You can send us an email at mildlyalarmingshow@gmail.com.
You can leave a comment on the website at www.mildlyalarming.com. You can listen to us on the website via the RSS feed or the embedded player. You can find us on iTunes or Stitcher or soon, but not yet, Google Play Music, where you can also leave us a review. Please leave us a good one. And we're also on TuneIn Radio.
Or... You can go deep cover behind the Iron Curtain. Just really almost get to the part where you've forgotten what it's like to taste, you know, the burger of freedom. You can fall deeply in love with a lovely Ukrainian girl named Svetlana, you know, and just live there for years. And then as she stabs you in the back in a dark alley somewhere in Bucharest, and your blood pools on the flagstones, and you realize that she was a Soviet agent all along. And as she looks down pitilessly as your life ebbs, you can whisper your question to the uncaring wind, and it will come to us.
All of those things are true.
See you next week.
on the Mildly Alarming Podcast.
The Mildly Alarming Podcast is pleased to announce the launch of our second internet radio project, Get Turnt with Johannes and Tom. This 11-hour show will discuss all things turnt, getting turnt, being turnt, turnting up, turnting down, taking turnts, turnt toast, turnt sienna, turnt signals, turnt lanes, scratching records on a turnt table, and of course, turntles of the teenage and or mutant ninja variety. If you get turnt, got turnt, or are turnt at this very minute, you won't want to miss the 6-day premiere of Get Turnt with Johannes and Tom. Turnt down for what? Turnt down for this.